Dr. Show! You have all made it through the dance. You have all made it nerdy.
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 71. I'm your host, John X. Thank you for joining us. Glad to have you back once again on this week's show, Science and Technology. That's right. Big time science show this week. Something that I am super excited about. Good buddy of mine on the show. Someone, we got more radio people. You hear themes. It's either Golden High School Class of 2000 or KCSU alumni. This week, KCSU alumni, and it's Aaron Mercer. Now, Aaron Mercer is currently a research scientist for Novo Nordisk, one of the leading biotech companies in the country and probably the world. He's doing fascinating work on obesity, on diabetes, on neuroscience. He gets into it in the episode, so I'm not going to spoil it too much. But this week, I like to refer to this episode as how to be a scientist. Seriously, how does one become a scientist? Scientist to me is an abstraction, like probably PR person or professional communicator is to many others. Like, what do? Do you run experiments? Like, do you get your chemistry set out? Do you melt the carpet? That's the extent of my knowledge of what a professional scientist does. You know, outside of the companies and the individuals that I've worked with in my professional life who practice, you know, different types of science, geology and whatever. But in terms of like biomedical work, I know almost nothing about it. You know, that type of work, how does one do it? What are some of the things that you can do? Because beyond doctors, I don't know that a lot of us think about this with any level of nuance or intellectual curiosity. So Aaron provides that. He takes us through how a kid with an interest in science goes through high school, goes through undergrad, gets a PhD. He didn't get an MD, gets a PhD, and then does postdoc work before finding himself in the professional realm. And we also talk about some of the challenges in getting into that professional realm and how there's very little guidance. And that's something he and I could relate to. When you get beyond, I would say, undergrad in your academic career, there's not a lot of guidance for what the next steps are. They can mostly point you to more schooling or work at more research one institutions, but not a lot in terms of what else you can do in a professional sense. So having that conversation was just enormously enlightening and a lot of fun. One of the other things that we talk about that is something that I'm particularly interested in, given this is what I got my master's in, cultural studies, rhetoric, argumentation, media, that kind of thing, is how we understand science through the prism of culture. Like, how do we see scientists? The most obvious and sort of immediate reference, just because of its cultural prominence, is the Big Bang Theory. I mean, those guys are scientists, and those guys play into probably some of the biggest nerd stereotypes we have out there that have perpetuated for the last, I don't know, 40, 50 years. Aaron provides a really nice counterpoint to that because we spend a bunch of time in this podcast. He weaves in discussions about music. He talks about distance running. He talks about his love for cooking. We both love craft beer. And you go, wow, look at this. Like, PhD, research scientist, guy who did many years of postdoc, a guy who genetically engineered mice for the work that he's doing. Amazing stuff, right? And yet we spend a lot of time talking about craft beer and music and distance running and things like that. It's just awesome. He's an all-around kind of guy. He's one of my good friends, and it's just a pleasure to feature him on the show. We'll get to that here in just a second. A couple of notes before we get started. There's going to be no show next week. It is Labor Day coming up on Monday. And so given that and people's schedules, almost everyone's out of town. Everything that I have going professionally and with this podcast is sort of at a standstill at the moment, just because people are like, yep, it's Labor Day. It's the end of summer. I'm on vacation, or I don't want to think about it. I don't want to talk about it. We'll get to it next week. So in the spirit of that, we're going to take next week off and no new show next week, but we'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode of the John of All Trades podcast. Additionally, I'd just like to say something here on the podcast because I wrote about this. It appeared on the John of All Trades blog. You can check it out at johnofalltrades.us. You can also find every episode I've done there. Start with episode one, because Mike Gaughan was the very first guest and the very first person I ever interviewed, and he recently passed away. I was really sad to hear that, and just really bummed out because Mike was such a mentor and such an inspiration to me. It was the reason I wanted him first. He had 3 Lifetime Achievement Awards in public relations, and at his core, he was a humanist. And the way that he handled the economic downturn while I was working for him, along with his partners, Jeff Julin and Cricket Smith, they're just 3 of the most lovely people I've ever met, and my heart aches for them and for Mike. And so I wrote a tribute to him. Check it out on the blog. Listen to his episode again, episode 1. And it's funny, I went back and listened to that episode. It's a great interview. Mike's a great guy, funny dude. And I listened to the intro, though, and man, right from the get-go, I'm like, this is pretty brutal. So I think I've gotten better over time, but, you know, who the hell knows. Rest in peace, Mike Gaughan. I'm desperately going to miss you. I hope to be as good a man as you are and see you on the other side. Hopefully we'll share a vodka. Thoughts and prayers to everyone who loved Mike Gaughan. Don't mean to cast sort of a pall over this episode because it's really, really good. So let's get back into it. It's episode 71. We're coming up on Labor Day. So let's talk some science here with Aaron Mercer. He is a research scientist at Novo Nordisk. This episode, subtitle, How to Be a Scientist. Let's start it up. It begins right now.
The city's crazy, not too much of a culture shock for me, because having just come from Ann Arbor, it's a lot of rich, white, liberal people, and that's kind of what Seattle is, too.
Right.
But I'm totally down with it, because it's like, I like to run, I have, you know, all my expensive running gear, and I do occasionally eat organic food, so, and there's lots of breweries because of that, too. Everybody's into their craft beer here, so it's, I want to say Washington State has like 278 breweries, so I know it's in the top 5 with like Colorado and Oregon.
Yeah, that's pretty good, and obviously California.
Oh, yeah. I know, I've been spoiled, so, you know, I'm originally from Colorado, did my postdoc in Michigan, and now I'm in Washington, so I've been in 3 of the top 5.
Wow.
For the chunk of my life.
Yeah, very nicely done. Kristen and I are going to Portland next weekend, and it'll be my first time there. I'm excited to see what that scene's all about.
I know. Yeah, down there, Portland's crazy. Even the people that are here in Seattle that moved out from Portland, they're like, yeah, Portland's better for beer. And if I went down to Portland, I would probably just be drunk for like an entire weekend, because there'd be so many beers I'd want to try.
Well, I'm worried about like gaining 100 pounds when I go there. Because of the beer and from what I understand about the food scene, too.
Yeah.
Who's the best brewer you've been to so far?
Fremont Brewing, for sure. Although, I haven't been to a lot of tastings, and I would like to do that, because I think that's a good way to, you know, cover a more broad repertoire than buying a six-pack at the grocery store.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're friends on Facebook. You see Kristen and I check in almost every Friday at a new place in Denver.
Right. I know.
But talking to Aaron Mercer, who is, what is your title? Are you a research scientist or?
Yeah, research scientist is my official title.
Okay. At Novo Nordisk. And could you tell me a little bit about what Novo Nordisk does?
Yeah, so Novo Nordisk, they were founded in Denmark. I think they were one of the first biotech companies. They started in like 1928, but I don't think they were publicly traded until maybe the early 80s. But even still, one of the very first publicly traded biotech companies also. They got rolling. They were one of the first European groups to synthesize insulin once that was discovered, you know, last century.
Right.
So they've basically been a diabetes company forever and ever and ever. And within the last 5 or 10 years, they had a product called Victoza, which is, it's a hormone mimetic, and it seems to help people control their blood glucose, which, you know, is obviously important for diabetes. But they found with some of their patients that it was also causing some weight loss. So
huh.
They thought, well, obesity and diabetes are tied pretty close together. Maybe we want to start thinking about doing some obesity research too, you know?
Just
kind of expand the portfolio. So they had kind of a focus group rolling over in the headquarters over in Copenhagen, and then decided to push and basically build up a facility here in Seattle to do drug discovery for that arm of the company.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I have a sense for why this is, but, you know, I'd like to hear from someone who's an expert. Obesity and diabetes are linked, but why is that?
So the big thing that happens is as you're gaining weight, you get all these extra signals that are coming out of the fat tissue as you're getting bigger as you become more obese. Part of what happens, though, is you're getting more calories also going through your blood. Your body's pumping out more insulin to try to, you know, put those calories away.
Yeah, handle all the sugars and just basically all the input that you're giving it, right?
Right. The problem is, and it, you know, obviously this is going to vary person to person just because you have biological variability, but you eventually hit this threshold where your body stops being sensitive to insulin.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like as you drive the system too hard, you burn it out. So then the problem is your nutrients, your glucose and things don't get stored in the right place. So not only do you have your kind of visceral adipose tissue that you see, you know, when you see a very obese individual, but it also starts storing fat in places you really don't want it, which is like on organs and in organs, particularly the liver.
Yeah, yeah.
And things just go downhill from there. So, yeah, obesity is a very, very complicated disease. That's also part of why they kind of need a big facility with tons of disciplines here, because it's like, obesity is not just a fat issue. I did my research fellowship working on sort of the brain control of metabolism. Yeah, when you have metabolic syndrome or obesity, it's affecting every single part of your body. So,
wow. So
yeah, we have people here that are muscle experts, fat experts, brain experts. You know, we're getting liver, GI, kidney, pancreas. I mean, pretty much any organ you can think of. I think we even have muscle physiologists coming in. Yeah, it's the whole shebang.
So are you in the brain expert group? Because you mentioned that was what you did your research fellowship on.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. I'm in the, I guess we can call me in the tech geek group. My official department is research technologies. So I got hired in. A lot of my research fellowship was doing some neuroanatomy. And what that is I was using, I like to call them my GMO mice. They're transgenic animals.
Okay.
So I was doing circuit mapping because a lot of these parts of the brain that control metabolism, how we eat, we actually know what the cells are. We don't really know where they're going or how they're talking to other systems in the brain. So because of that background, the initial focus of this unit is very heavy on neuroscience.
Okay.
But I've also done just a lot of general anatomy. So my official job title or the unit that I run within research technologies is histology and histochemistry, which is essentially an anatomy core.
What are you doing basically on a day-to-day basis? Like, what does being a research scientist at a company like this entail? So, like, what are your duties and what does your day look like?
Well, right now it's pretty hilarious because half of our unit, in terms of building space, they're still doing construction on. So the lab that all my equipment will be in won't open until February. So it's kind of funny that I'm here now since I have, what are we looking at, about 6 months?
Yeah, 6 months.
So mostly what I get to do right now is start to, like, organize based on existing histology at the site here in Seattle. And then I'm just going to talk to lots of vendors about blowing lots and lots of money on new equipment. So that's my day-to-day right now.
Okay.
And I mean, coming from academics into industry, where academia, like a lot of times with a lab, you get a startup package. That's how you buy a lot of your big equipment. And then when you get a grant, that pays for people, consumables, you know, that sort of thing.
Right, right.
Here at Novo Nordisk, so we don't quite have a blank check mentality going with our equipment right now, but they want us to be state-of-the-art. So they're just like, yeah.
Right, right. They'll get you what you need to facilitate doing your job to be leading the industry, essentially, is what you're describing.
Right. And so the interesting thing now, the other task that I'm working on is actually getting an associate scientist under me with industry background, because part of it for me, a lot of why they hired me was sort of the academic mindset of being able to plan experiments and follow them through.
Right.
But I need somebody with industry experience who can handle all the automated systems that I never got to use at the university, which would be kind of nice to have that interface.
Yeah, no, that's totally the other side where, like, the yin and the yang of that is important. And is your mind sort of blown going from what you were working on in academia to what you have at your disposal here?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And the other interesting thing is working for Novo Nordisk, which is a Danish company. They're all about, you know, work-life balance and all that fun stuff. So they're like, yeah, you know, if the workload gets too demanding, they're pretty flexible with this site. Like, if we just need to hire more people, you just tell us. I'm like, oh, okay.
So that sounds like Amazon was in the news recently, and it sounds like the polar opposite of that.
Oh, I know. And it's the hilarious thing is Amazon's across the street from me downtown.
Okay. That's quite the counterpoint then.
Right. I actually don't know any Amazon employees yet, but it is interesting. The people that I work with who've been in Seattle for quite a while, they said, well, I haven't heard any of the like terrible horror stories about, you know, getting fired for being on leave with cancer or something like that, or having a story like a stillborn baby or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. A lady had a miscarriage. And I think came in the next day. And I don't remember what the repercussions were, but I remember that was the sort of the key component of the story.
Yeah, and they were like, you didn't answer your emails.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so I mean, I can't speak to knowing, you know, having personal connections to that. But yeah, I can speak to my company being just like they're, and even still, it's like, you know, I started in July, so I don't get the full number of vacation days, but they're like, oh, yeah, but still, make sure you still get, like, 6 vacation days and 2 floating holidays, so make sure you use those.
Cool.
I just started. Like, I've been here a month. They're telling me to take my vacation days.
Well, that's awesome, dude. Okay, so this is kind of a hypothetical.
Right.
Let's say you are successful, and, I mean, that could take any number of shapes, but let's say you find incredible success. You run an experiment that you go, oh, my God, like, I've done it. What is it that you've done, and what kind of impact does that have on society, on, you know, diabetes, on obesity, whatever? So, like, what would ultimate success look like for you at this company?
I think for us is to actually have a product that comes out. I don't think we're going to come up with a magic, like, miracle weight loss drug. If you remember from physics class way back in the day, the second law of thermodynamics, that matter can't be created or destroyed.
Right. It all just exists, and it changes form, essentially.
Right. So if you're morbidly obese and you have lots of calories stored in your body, those, to get rid of them, you either have to burn them or excrete them. So
right, right.
In either case of that, it's like, well, if you want to do that really fast and burn it off really fast, you're either going to be on the toilet a lot.
Right.
Or you're going to basically have a fever for a very, very long time.
Okay.
So we're probably not going to be able to, you know, come up with some magic pill that can just instantaneously melt weight off.
Yeah, just vaporize, like, you know, extra mass off, you know, off your body.
Right. So I think with the company, I mean, there's some internal ideas of, like, an ideal change in body weight that we'd like to hit, you know, if we get a good lead compound. Another big, very important thing with obesity, though, is improving the metabolic profile. So that means making sure there's fat not getting deposited in the wrong places, making sure somebody's more insulin sensitive, helping their mobility so they can actually exercise, you know, and just get around in their day-to-day life. The challenging thing, though, is I think the stigma that's associated with obesity is so much of, like, you know, it's my size.
Right, right.
So that's challenging because it's like, even if you have a great drug that can really improve a metabolic profile, that may not be a, you know, something that's quite as noticeable. But in any event, you know, I think the overarching goal is just to have better quality of life, I think.
Right. Well, it's funny what you're describing. You're describing almost like the societal or social component of obesity, not the actual sort of physiological impacts that it has, right?
Right. Well, in longer term, I mean, the other problem is, like, obesity unto itself, it's kind of controversial right now because I think the American Medical Association, they're trying to get it called a disease, I think, so that insurance can start covering some of these drugs.
Right.
Or other treatments. But the problem is, it's actually the obesity itself is not really the problem, but it's all the downstream things, like type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease and things of that sort. I think, yeah, there's a huge correlation between obesity and cancer incident, especially in older patients. So
okay.
It's kind of a stepping stone to worse things, but there's nothing good that comes out of having obesity.
Well, no, I can't imagine that there is. I can't even think of one. There's really no advantage to being obese. It's, you know, it's socially stigmatized. You mentioned all the downstream issues. Health impacts. Yeah, it's a tough thing. So that leads me into a question, and I'm kind of working in reverse here, but how did you become interested in this particular subset of science?
So I guess I'll back up a little bit too. So when I was an undergrad at Colorado State, I knew for a really, really, really long time I wanted to do something in biology. Like, I was into science. I was really into animals as a kid. I thought I'd be a vet, maybe. That's actually why I went to CSU, because I thought, oh, I can go to vet school.
Oh, the vet. Yeah, the vet program?
Yeah. Yeah, CSU is where the vet school is.
Right.
I couldn't really make up my mind. And then I took some neuroscience classes, and I was like, oh, my God, this is awesome. And then I also realized, okay, well, there's things that exist called a PhD. So you can get paid to get an advanced degree to do research. I'm like, that's amazing. Get paid to get a degree, like, you know, doing work that's super interesting. So
yeah,
that's kind of how I got into neuroscience. But I was terrible at actually, like, getting into a program. Like, I didn't do any undergrad, like, summer internships or anything like that. So,
well, okay, I need to stop you for just a second, because so two things. One, we met at the radio, and so, I mean, most of the radio nerds were like journalism or like communications or, you know, maybe like a handful of business people or, you know, like econ, something in liberal arts. And so, you know, here you are with a passion for neuroscience. And I didn't even know that. Like, I didn't know what your major was. I just figured, I'm like, I wonder why I never see Aaron in any of my classes. But
that's why.
Yeah, that's clearly why. I remember you were over at my apartment in like spring of 2006. You know, I was getting ready to graduate. I think, is that when you finished up there as well?
Yeah, 2006.
Okay, so yeah, we were in my apartment. I go, what's next for you? You're like, oh, I'm off to Nebraska for med school. And I go, what? Like, I didn't even know that. So, you know, we didn't get a ton of science people at the radio. What was your interest in sort of getting involved at KCSU before we like go back to the science part?
Oh, yeah. So I've always been a huge music fan. I think part of it for me with KCSU was, I mean, kind of the glory of just being on the radio and just blasting music, because I thought it was cool. And, like, I'm still kind of one of those people that, like, I'll get on social media and I'm like, hey, this band put out a video, it's super rad, and, like, nobody cares, but I think it's cool, so.
Right.
I'm just generally a music fan. But I think it was my sophomore year of undergrad, Brittany Lipke.
Yeah, I remember Brittany.
Yeah, Stimpy. I think Stimpy was her KCSU, her on-air name. So yeah, so she was actually doing the DJ thing, and I think I mentioned like going to some shows, and she goes, yeah, you should come check out the radio station. And I think at the time when I finally did that, Tucker Gumber / the festival guy / DJ Hollywood, he was the training director, and like there's no way you're not going to go work at KCSU when he's training director. Like,
no,
that guy's great. So
that guy's got he's the most enthusiastic person I've ever known in my life.
I know about anything.
Well, everything really. When you talk to him, you're like, damn, like my day is better now. I talked to Tucker, and I told him next time he comes through Denver, I want to have him on the show, just because you got to get that energy out in the world.
I know. So I mean, I really liked the people that were there. I think that was like 2004 is when I started at the radio station, but. Another thing for me, being a poor college student, I was like, wait, I have access to tons of free music, and I can occasionally get free concert tickets. Like, that was also a huge perk, because I spent enough money doing that anyways in my free time. So I thought, oh, well, why not work with an organization that'll, like, let me go do that for free, like, having a table there.
Well, and it had to be sort of a change of pace for you from the, like, the science folks you were around, you know, all day in your classes.
Right. Well, and a lot of them were too serious. I think that's even why I went to grad school instead of medical school, because I'm like, I'm totally not type A enough. I also kind of partied a lot early on in college, and I don't think I quite had the GPA to go to med school right away.
Well, I mean, you were at my apartment, so, I mean, that's, you know, that's bad enough. KCSU parties were, I mean, they were fantastic. Going over to, like, Casey and Merrick's house. And
yeah, and I remember, man, Mike Santos and I in the summers, it's like we just lived on Sullivan's patio. Like,
yeah. Yeah, no, fantastic. So, okay, you were telling me about how you always, you know, you said, I can get paid to basically do science experiments, right? And
yeah.
So that was sort of the driving factor for you.
Yeah, I actually had no debt coming out of undergrad, and I thought, hey, I can get another degree and still have no debt. That's amazing.
Same thing happened to me. I did graduate school in speech, and I'm like, oh, I could teach public speaking, and they'll pay me to do that? That's crazy.
Yeah, so, I mean, and that's a little naive, but it's also hard to think, because, like, for me at the time, I mean, I didn't have lots of real-life experience to know exactly what job I wanted. I just knew if you get a bachelor's degree in biology, your career options are really, really limited without something more.
Right.
So, for most people, you know, some degree whether it's a master's, a PhD, an MD, you know, some other professional career in, like, you know, say physical therapy, almost everybody that's in biology and wants a biology type of degree has to do something after their bachelor's. Like, that's just kind of the nature of the beast. I'm kind of afraid for my kids. Like, if they want to do science, I'm like, you're going to need, like, an MD and a PhD and, like, three other things to get a job.
Right. I want to ask you something about undergrad, because when we were emailing before we started talking, you mentioned to me organic chemistry, which,
oh, yeah.
Which I have a couple of people who I know who've gone through science degrees. Without fail, universally, everyone bitches about OChem. And yeah. What is it about that class that is so brutal? Yeah, give me the rundown on why OChem is always like sort of the lighthouse in the fog of, you know, academia.
Well, it's something where I think it's just ridiculously abstract. It's way more advanced than just general chemistry, because general chemistry is like, oh, kind of learning the periodic table and, you know, some of the basics. But, like, OChem is putting all those things together into, like, three-dimensional structures and how do they interact. And it's weird, because I'm a very visual person and kind of an abstract thinker in terms of, like, I mean, that's part of why I like doing anatomy, is because I like to visualize things. But, like, OChem just... The only thing that made sense to me in organic chemistry was when we did, like, the structures of proteins or sugars, like, actual biological molecules. Like, you know, most of it was just, like, way over my head.
Yeah.
That's what it really boiled down to. And it was things that, since you couldn't really conceptualize, like, how they're used in the real world, it's like, when it had no application, it made it really hard for me to care about it, too. So it's like, when I don't care about it, that makes it, you know, really difficult to push studying it.
That was my problem when I took statistics, because for like the first month or so you take statistics and you go, okay, I get this, you know, confidence interval, you know, standard deviation, all that kind of stuff. You go, this makes sense. And then you get deeper and deeper and deeper into it and you go, what are we even doing anymore?
Or does it mean anything?
Yeah, exactly. And so, okay, that makes sense to me. So having taken organic chemistry, is it more of a class to sort of just like test your mettle and go, okay, do you really want a career in science? Because it's hard, and this is a good example of how. And if you're not down for this, get out now. Or does OChem like have some actual applicability in what you do?
I would say both. I mean, I don't have a lot to do with OChem in my day to day because I'm kind of so macro in terms of biological function.
Right.
I think, though, the professor that I even had at CSU that I just loathed, that was terrible, he taught an honors course for organic chemistry, and supposedly the students that were in that said it was great. I think that, like, very general big class, they just were like, buckle up, this is the weirdo class from med school.
Okay.
And so they just purposely made it hard so that they're like, yeah, well, part of it could also be that once you're past those prereqs, there's also just not the... I mean, yeah, it's like if you can't pass those hoops to even qualify to try to get into med school, like, why should you possibly be qualified to be a doctor, I guess? Maybe the mindset. So, but there were other classes, too, that I had to take. Like, I had to take a couple semesters of physics. I kind of get it in terms of, like, my bench science now, like, knowing some physics. But, yeah, for being a doctor, it never made sense to me. But,
well, whatever.
There must be some rhyme to the reason that I don't know.
Well, I think it's probably just an ever increasing level of hurdles. So, like, you can clear this hurdle. All right, the next one's higher, and you know the tests just continue to get harder. So it and you're going to get thrown curveballs no matter what your sort of, you know, field of discipline is. And it's important to go, oh my God, so this came from this side. I sort of get it. I mean, yeah, I haven't used calculus since college, but I'm happy to have learned it because it makes me go, okay, I can take something that has what appears to be very little applicability and turn it into something more meaningful. I mean, that's just a useful skill to have no matter who you are.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point is, you know, in science, even if you're not in, you know, a set particular discipline of a course you have to take, I mean, what I do and what, you know, medical doctors do in their offices every day is we have to use logic and critical thinking to solve problems.
Right.
So being able to do that is, I mean, that's like skill number one for our jobs.
Right. So after CSU, you headed off to Nebraska, right?
Right.
And was that, you said grad school, not med school. What was Nebraska?
It was grad school, yeah. So I don't have an MD. I didn't go to medical school.
Okay,
so
gotcha.
So yeah, it was kind of an interesting fluke. So I was really bad at applying to my grad programs on time. Like, not that I missed the dates, but I applied really late.
Right.
So if any programs had rolling admissions, I totally shot myself. I got a really good GRE score, though. So, like, I think it was March of 2006. Like, I wanted to go to grad school, and my only lead was the master's program at CSU.
Right.
And then out of the blue, I get mail from Nebraska Medical Center, and they're like, hey, what do you think about joining our umbrella program to, you know, do a PhD in biomedical science? And I'm like, okay, because that's what I want to do.
You had to take the GRE? That seems weird to me, because I had to take the GRE for a master's in speech.
Yeah, and the hilarious thing is I looked at the, you know, the score breakdowns on what different disciplines kind of fall into.
Yeah.
And I think everybody in science gets, like, you know, in the 750s for math and, like, in the 500s for verbal, like, terrible in verbal. Because we're like, we know all of our science-y words. We just don't know general, complicated English vocabulary, I guess.
Right. That's funny. And oddly enough, okay, so you remember when you take the GRE and you take the math and the verbal section, and then the third section is whichever one you scored higher on, you get it again?
No, mine wasn't like that. I had to do math, verbal, and then I had a writing.
Yeah, well, I had a writing piece as well, but I remember there being three sections. And so, yeah, it was math, verbal, and then the third one was you got another section of whichever one you already scored higher on.
Oh, weird. I don't remember that.
And so I'm assuming you probably got math again, but the weird thing is I got math again too. And so I go, okay. And I got my scores back, and I scored way higher in math than I did verbal. But I got like the highest score you could get on writing. So I go, okay, I think I'll be okay.
Right.
But yeah, it was anyway. It was just weird. So you got into the biomedical program at Nebraska, and what was entailed in that?
Well, it was very broad. So it was called the Biomedical Research Training Program, and the way the program worked is they covered the first year of your grad school, and then during that first year, you would basically do a little pilot run in different labs to figure out where to do your PhD.
Okay.
And it was open to anything in the university, which was kind of nice, because even though I knew I pretty much wanted to do neuroscience, since I didn't have a lot of like formal lab experience, it gave me the opportunity to try different labs. But yeah, I learned really quickly that I'm like, yeah, I'm doing neuroscience. I don't want to do microbiology. I'm not that interested in bacteria. So yeah, so I actually worked in two labs in grad school, though. So the first one, I'd been in the lab about a year, and the professor I was working with was like, hey guys, I'm moving to Philadelphia.
Okay.
Bringing the lab with me. My problem was, it was right before I got married, and my wife also, like, we owned a house, and she had a teaching contract at Creighton University. So my big question was, well, is my degree going to be in Nebraska, or is it going to be from Temple out in Philly? And he said, Nebraska. So I'm like, I'm going to stay here. It's going to be way easier on me to not move cross-country and have downtime while the lab gets rebuilt to wait on you guys. So yeah, it was actually for the best. I mean, I still talk to those guys quite a bit.
Sure.
They're good contacts to have, but man, my PhD mentor was super cool. He's actually coming out to Seattle next week, and we're going to go have some beers.
Nice, man.
But yeah, we'd go, I mean, obviously I had to do my lab work, do my neuroscience studies, but he was a big music fan, so like when I interviewed for grad school, like all we talked about was shows. And then, all through grad school, yeah, we'd go drink beer together, go catch music. My wife thought it was kind of weird. She's like, you're like best friends with your boss.
Yeah.
I'm like, what's the problem?
You're like, so what?
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, and even still, like, through Dropbox, we swap music and things like that, so.
That's a good time.
I think it also completely biased me to expect that, like, oh, man, every boss I'm going to have in science is going to be super cool. Like, my postdoc mentor is a good guy, but definitely not the same relationships.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I mean, that's kind of unusual, but it's like anything else. You know, people will ask you questions that are impossible to answer. You know, like, was that weird? And you go, no, because, you know, it was what it was. People will ask me, like, is it weird to be an only child? And I go, compared to what? Like, how do I answer that?
You're like, I don't have a parallel life where I had siblings. So.
Right. Yeah, I don't think I'm in the darkest timeline here. So, you know, I don't know. But how long was that program?
So the PhD, my whole program, like, the year of the umbrella, and even though I had to swap labs, I got in and out in 5 years, and that's actually pretty common. Like, I think most PhDs are anywhere from, like, 4 to 7 years. A lot of that depends on your committees and your supervisor and all that signing off on saying you're done. So most right. people in Michigan, I know, for some reason, they're rolling like 6 years. But part of that's because we work with our the fancy mouse models. Especially if you have to build one, like that takes 2 years by itself.
Oh my God. Wait, building a fancy mouse model, what are you talking about?
Yeah, so that's one thing that's, it's actually pretty common in science now. They call them transgenic mice. You basically are going in and changing something. So say you can have like a fluorescent reporter in a certain tissue, or you're going to take a gene in or a gene out. But you have to do that, but it's like the checks and balances during the R&D event to just make sure that your model is correct. I mean, I built a mouse like that during my postdoc, and I think it took a good like year and a half before I was finally getting to having any data out of it.
Wow, that's wild.
That's why it's R&D. It's a slow process.
Yeah, well, getting it right, of course. Okay, so you got the PhD. How'd you enjoy Lincoln?
I was actually in Omaha.
I'm sorry.
Driving through Nebraska, myself included. So Omaha is pretty cool. I mean, it's a city of like, I think now they have maybe almost 5 million people.
Wow.
A pretty good music scene because Saddle Creek Records is based there. And I think Connor Overs helped build this like brand new music venue that was super amazing, like really good acoustics.
Nice.
So there was that. And I mean, a lot of my good buddies in grad school, you know, we know all the good bars. So there was stuff to do. Since it was Nebraska, though, and there wasn't a lot of great outdoors things, that's when I got into marathon running. So I thought, well, nothing else to do on my weekends. Why not go run for 4 hours?
Yeah, well, fair enough. You know,
yeah, what's interesting is the running, and I got into cooking and just reading about nutrition and things. And so while I was getting this PhD in neuroscience, I was like, hey, well, the brain actually controls metabolism. Maybe I should do that for my postdoc.
So oh, nice.
Do the brain control and metabolism. So that's sort of how I rolled into what I'm doing now with Novo Nordisk.
Okay, before you talk about that, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's so striking to me about this conversation, and I've known you since college now, but you know, when you're talking to a neuroscientist, right? Someone who is a research scientist, you don't expect, you know, all this conversation because you keep bringing up music and you keep bringing up beer. And, you know, all these different types of interests you have. And you mentioned when you were in undergrad, you know, a lot of the science people were very serious. When you are in these programs, and I understand you always find sort of your own tribe. Wherever you go, you'll find people you relate to. But is that ever like a cultural issue for you? Because, you know, do you run up against people who are like science, 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 like, you know, the caricatures on the Big Bang Theory, that kind of thing? Is that a thing for you, or is that something that the media wants to tell us about what scientists are like?
It's a little mixed. I would say I probably saw a few more people like that when I was at the University of Michigan, just because Michigan's, you know, it's one of the top 10 research institutes in the country.
Okay.
So you have the people that are like, I want to be a young gunner. I want to make a name for myself. I want to get these grants, get my own lab. I want a big publication. By and large, though, I mean, most people I know are not, you know, workaholics that only eat, sleep, and breathe science. Now, in terms of the people I was kind of complaining about in undergrad, I think those were the people that were wanting to go to med school. And not to say that I don't know great people that are also well-balanced that have their MDs, but I think also the stress and the pressure and the competition to actually, you know, get perfect grades and get through undergrad and get right into medical school are really, really high because there's so many people wanting to do it. So it's like if you're not going to eat, sleep, and breathe science to get into med school, you may not get in.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, it requires just almost, yeah, an even more intense level of dedication, which will necessarily limit some of your outside interests.
Yeah, and I mean, so for me, it was all about finding a balance because I'm just like, because even after, you know, I didn't get my great grades in organic chemistry. Not that I couldn't have tried to go to medical school, but I was just like, there's a lot of good things I'm going to miss out on in life if I'm like, if that's all I'm focused on and really myopic for the next like 10 years.
No, that's, I mean, it's a great point. And no matter what sort of profession you're in, you'll encounter that. You know, you meet career driven people in communications too. And it's like, how can you be this dedicated to, you know, the things that we do, because sometimes it can feel like pretty ethereal. But the reason I'm compelled to ask the question is because we're told, and for years we've been given portrayals of people in science who are all portrayed in a very particular way. And so you're always curious about how much of that is actually rooted in reality. And it sounds like not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot. And I think for me, it's also one of those things where I don't want to burn out. I'm like, I am, you know, really dedicated and interested in what I do, but I also work way better when it's like, when I'm not in front of a computer, when I can go running, when I can just have a break. Like, even yesterday after lunch, I mean, we had this, like, I forget what the name of the meeting was, but we had this, like, 3-hour, like, mega meeting in the morning.
Yeah.
And so I had lunch, and then I'm like, I'm going to go run a 10K, because I sat for 3 hours, and that's just how it is.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
100%.
I was way more productive for the rest of the afternoon, so it's like...
Yeah, I'm totally the same way. I was just sweating blood on this writing project that I have, because I work for myself now.
Right.
And I'm sitting there just flagellating myself, just torturing myself over it. Like, I'm like, oh, I can't finish this. Yeah. And so I put it down and I walked away. And I think I even just went and like plugged in my old Xbox and just started playing Tony Hawk for like 20 minutes. And at some point in the middle of this run, I go, ah, I got it. And then all of a sudden it just flowed and it was going. When people are so hyper-focused, and I used to work for a guy at one point who would work like 16-hour days, I'm like, how do you have anything left to give?
Right.
I don't understand that mindset. Yeah, you're right. It's important to be well-rounded.
Well, and I think just me, I mean, some of it could be stamina, but it's like, I know when I reach like in any given business day, like if I hit 10 hours, like my returns after that are so diminishing. I'm like, I might as well just go home and eat dinner. It's like, I can sit here and sit. And even now, I mean, I'm salaried, so it's not like I have to clock hours, but it's like, well, I can even, you know, sit in the office and pretend like I'm being super productive. And I'm like, I'm sitting in the office surfing the web. And that's not, I'm like, just, it's like, go home.
go be productive in a different sector of your life.
Yeah. Go be productive. Like as a human, drowning, so.
Yeah, no joke. So, okay. So you get into cooking and, you know, and running. And so you go and you have this intersection of the two parts of yourself, and that facilitated you going off to Michigan.
Yeah. It was actually a lot more work than you think. So what's interesting with, like, so a lot of people, when they finish their PhD, is they roll into their postdoc. In many instances, it's who your boss knows is where you go and do your postdoc. Typically that's how it is. So for
right.
me, it was totally like jumping fields, because my PhD, we used the retina, so the neural tissue in the back of your eye. We used that as a model to study neural connections, like how they talk to one another.
Yeah.
So yeah, so when I was hunting for postdocs, I interviewed with a couple of labs in that area. But yeah, I told my boss, I was like, hey, I'm looking at this lab in Michigan. It's brain control of metabolism. And he's like, what? And I mean, initially he was kind of surprised, but then it's like, you know, granted my interest in these other things, he's like, oh, that makes total sense. So
yeah.
With scientists, they get a little bummed if you're not continuing their lineage, I think. It's like, oh, well, if you stay in the same field, you can still work on papers together and, like, you know, build this network of researchers. But on the other hand, the postdoc, you're also supposed to go learn things and new things that you don't know, so... I don't know. I think it varies person to person. Some people just go to whatever postdoc their PhD mentor recommends. I applied to like 30 different labs, and I think I could have gone on about 8 interviews. I maybe did 5.
Yeah.
To finally go to Michigan. I really had to pester the guy that I worked for because he's super busy. But yeah, a really good guy. Michigan was great. Despite being competitive in a top 10 institute, everybody's super collegial, which is really nice. And there's, because it's also a top 10 institute, there's money to do things. That's kind of in short order right now for a lot of researchers. So, I mean, it was nice to have the infrastructure and the, you know, everything in place to be able to do our work, which is really nice. But yeah, it makes it very tough for your kind of post-postdoc to try to actually get said money and start your own lab. So that's where the big divergences now are in science. It's like, not everybody can, there's not enough money for everybody to be an academic scientist. So that's why I'm in Seattle now.
Right.
Partly.
So when you're in a postdoc program, what were you doing there? And like, what types of, you mentioned a little bit about the research, but can you build more on that? Like, what were you doing?
So the postdoc is kind of interesting because you're, I would say in terms of the day-to-day, it's not ridiculous. ridiculously different than when I was a student, because you're essentially coming in and doing the experiments for the lab, but I think there's a lot more emphasis placed on, like, if your lab has money from the NIH, you're driving the research. That's, like, the NIH is giving you the money for.
Yeah.
And you're a lot more responsible for, like, equipment maintenance and helping train undergraduate students and things like that. So it is more of a professional development, sort of to groom you, I guess, to kind of run your own unit, regardless of what that is. The problem, though, now in this country is we're pumping out so many PhDs in science, and there's a lot of people coming in from overseas to do their postdocs, that we're starting to reach kind of critical mass and then, like, figuring out jobs for everybody after their postdoc. Or I know people that they've been in a postdoc position for, like, 10 years, and we weren't wanting in terms of money or anything, but, man, for the years of education you get for what a postdoc pays is kind of pitiful. And there's people that had been a postdoc for 10 years and were, like, not quite making $50,000 a year.
Wow.
Yeah, so they'd be almost 40 and, you know.
Yeah, still grinding it out, like, you know, they're sort of entry level, because, man,
yeah,
not making $50,000, you have these advanced degrees, and that's insane to me.
Right. Well, and even that, like, that was a sort of interesting eye-opener when I counted up the numbers of years of education I've had. So basically this summer when I left Michigan for Seattle, I was like, wow, I have 13 years of education after high school. So I have double the number of years of somebody that just did K through 12.
My God.
And then, yeah, my salary when I left Michigan, I think was, yeah, like 45,000, 46,000.
Wow.
So
outrageous.
But yeah, you don't do academic science for the love of money. If you want to make money, you do something else.
Yeah, no, clearly. You touched on this, and it's something that you hear about in the news sometimes. And as someone with a passion for science, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on how we remedy this potentially. But you mentioned there's so many people coming over here to do their postdocs that we don't necessarily have jobs for everyone. But you hear about a crisis in kids who are not as interested in science as they used to be. And how do you sort of remedy that? You know, what, like, how do we embolden the sciences and the professions in which science is useful? Is there a fix for that? Or, you know, what would be your recommendation, having gone through now 25 years of schooling?
Well, I think the interesting push that needs to start, it actually needs to happen way sooner. Like, I want to say maybe high school, but definitely in undergrad. I think they need to start structuring things into, you know, getting STEM training, but not having to follow the straight and narrow job path, just because it's, like, it's really limiting. But the problem is, like, whether it's undergrad, grad school, or during my postdoc, there's very little advice on doing anything except for being an academic research faculty. So, I mean, we had seminars and occasional outside speakers from people in industry or how to network or doing boot camps on resumes and things of that sort. But, like, there's no training given on, like, well, if you want to go into patent law or if you want to do policy with the government, like, you're just kind of on your own. There's no structure in our education system outside of general just academic science.
No,
I think that's a big fallacy. I don't really know what the remedy would be, if it's more like some of these businesses that absorb people with science backgrounds can start integrating back into the school systems, but
yeah,
that'd probably be a good start.
I agree, and I encountered the same thing when I was getting my master's degree. You know, they could recommend to you a good PhD program, but as far as getting a job and applying your degree, there was almost nothing. It's one of the reasons I do this show, is because I'm continually amazed at the different types of jobs that are out there. And I love just shining a light on that. I think about when I was in college, I didn't even know, like, what jobs existed. You know, you think about PR and you go, okay, you know, there's, like, a publicist for, like, Lindsay Lohan.
Right.
Or, you know, like, you could work in the media, which is increasingly drying up now too. But now that I'm in this, I see so many different types of applications to what I do that I just, as much as possible, I try and go back and talk to undergraduate kids, or people will send me, like, networking requests, like, hey, can you meet this person, do an informational interview with them? I do as many of those as possible, just because I remember, I don't know about you, but I felt kind of lost for a long time.
Yeah. Hey, and even probably the last year I felt kind of lost, to be honest.
Yeah.
So the problem with the postdoc right now, to jump back into, I guess, sort of my realm, is it's still considered a training period, and that's why we're not, you know, having money thrown at us.
Right.
Because it's like, well, you're still a trainee. You have a degree, so you get paid better, but you're still in training. But it's supposed to be a finite timeline. But there's nobody to facilitate, like, how long that timeline will be or what there is at the end of the timeline.
Yeah, so, what's the pony at the end of this rainbow?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, and I've heard it's, I mean, some people have been applying for jobs for years and, like, nothing's turned up. But I applied, I think, ever since early 2014, I applied to 120 jobs. I had 3 or 4 phone interviews. Nova was my one on-site interview, and I got it.
Wow.
So my odds of hitting, even with a PhD, you know, postdoc with the University of Michigan letterhead, I have one interview out of 120. Yeah. It's competitive.
Yeah. That's insane, man. Well,
and I think also with just globalization, I think, you know, it's interesting that, you know, as much as STEM and high tech jobs are getting pushed, it's like with how globalized we are, and how many other countries have people with these advanced degrees, it's like it's not like we're just limited to U.S. applicants. I mean, it's everybody in the world now fighting for all these jobs. So.
Yeah, 100%. So we are approaching time here. My last question I want to ask you is, you work with obesity and, you know, neuroscience, and so you're studying these things all the time. And frequently, like, we're friends on Facebook, and you post, you know, articles in this realm quite a bit, and they're always very, very interesting. Do you have something like a recommendation if someone is struggling with obesity, or no, you know what, better yet, if someone just wants to take good care of their body, what is the most important thing they could do? What is something that is obvious, but, you know, not really talked about? Is there something in this realm that you, as a professional scientist, say, this is something you should do or not do?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an accredited nutritionist, but I think the biggest...
Right, or a dietitian.
Or a dietitian. Yeah, I guess a dietitian is the one that you can actually get. I could say I'm a nutritionist, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you really can. And I had a dietitian on the show, which is why I make that distinction. She goes, I am not a nutritionist. I'm a registered dietitian.
Yeah, anybody can say they're a nutritionist.
That's right.
I think the biggest thing you can, like, anybody can do in their house is, like, if you struggle with overeating and junk food and those sorts of things, it's just, like, just don't buy it. Don't even have it in your house. Don't put it somewhere. Don't even put it in a locked cabinet. Just don't have it in your house. But the things to have would be, like, easy, healthy snacks, like nuts, dried fruit, like, also things that don't rot very easily.
Right, right.
Just because if you're like, well, I don't know if I'm going to eat those, you know, then you're not wasting money on food. But because then that way, like, if you're really hungry, you're not going to be tempted by the junk food. But if you have something healthier to eat at your house, you're not going to just go outside and go to McDonald's. I think the biggest thing, though, I mean, voluntary exercise is a part of, like, your total, like, burn on your body in a day. For most people, it's not that much. So the biggest thing is actually eating better.
Yeah. I found that when I lost weight, it was, like, I would say, like, 80 to 85% diet was, like, the driver for me.
But I still think, regardless, doing anything that can get your heart rate up, that's good cardiovascular fitness. I mean, and it doesn't need to be, like, I know I'm kind of an extreme example, and you probably remember on social media when I was marathon training how obnoxious I was. I don't think people need to go to that level, and I think especially somebody struggling with their weight, that's going to be way too hard on their joints. But it's like, just find something you like that, you know, gets you moving and gets your blood pumping.
Oh yeah, because yeah, you're right. For weight loss, it's almost all food, but the benefits to just regularly exercising are there are so many more. Just beyond, right, like, your body and, you know, losing weight, that when I don't exercise now, because I started doing this yoga program and I mix it with running. And when I get away from that for a couple of days, I feel just almost like deflated, like just gross, you know?
Yeah. No, and I had that earlier this week. I think I skipped Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And that's even part of yesterday. I had that 3-hour meeting and I'm like, I brought my running stuff and I'm going to take advantage of this because I'm feeling like crap today. And I felt 10 times better after I went running. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Those would be the two big things. Optimize your food environment in your house. And then, yeah, just physical activity. Whatever makes you happy is the important thing. Because I have a lot of people, since they know I love running, they're like, oh, should I run? And I'm like, well, if you hate it, no. Figure out something you like.
Yeah, not necessarily. Yeah, it's funny, optimizing your food environment. My mom brought over some cookies the other night. Like, they came over for dinner. And she goes, do you want me to leave these here? Or you guys don't keep a lot of sweets in the house, do you? And we go, we really don't. So, I mean, if you want to take them, you know, it's nice just not even having the option because you're right. You're like, God, I could really go for something. But the chances of you getting in your car and going out to get it, like that's like five more decision points that you have to make. So, yeah, you're right. Eliminating the convenience of it. I never really thought of that, but it's something that we've been doing here for a while and it's been really good.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, the thing I take away from this conversation most of all is, you know, you mentioned, you know, there's very little guidance when you're sort of going through all of your schooling and your postdoc about how to become a scientist or how to do it professionally, but you are doing it. And this is certainly one path to do it. And so it was so cool to get to hear the journey. And I would almost call this how to be a scientist, you know?
Yeah. Well, and the other big thing, I guess the advice I would also give people, I don't care if they want to do science or they want to do something else. You also a lot of it, I feel like, oh, I'm super lucky because I just happened to get to Michigan right when my boss Malcolm had moved. And it just so happened I was coming up on the end of my fellowship when Novo Nordisk opened this new site in Seattle. But it's also like, you got to network, you got to work hard, and you basically need to make your own luck, you know, on the job hunt.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the smartest characters in all of cinema, Billy Zane from Titanic, said, real man makes his own luck, right?
Right.
I mean, that guy was just filled with wisdom upon wisdom.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, hey, so this is the part of the show where you can plug anything you want. Do you have something you want to plug? If so, do it now.
I actually can plug our center here in Seattle. So any budding scientists out there, we're hiring and staffing up over like the next 2 years. So, you know, and if people want to bug me on LinkedIn, that's cool. I'd recommend not spamming me. I had one person asking about a job that sent 5 immediate follow-ups when I replied and then checks in twice weekly to, even though I can't hire her.
Good God.
So it's cool. Connect with me. Yeah, if you're interested. Also for, you know, people just in general, in terms of wanting to know about Novo Nordisk, or I also like to talk about exercise and nutrition, so people can bug me on social media as well if they want. I've started kind of pushing my Twitter platform, it's just amercer83, to talk about science and nutrition and my general happenings in Seattle, so that's another avenue too.
That's awesome, man. And I'm already friends with you on all of those places, which makes me happy about being me. That's right. All right. Well, Aaron, this was enormously informative. Thanks for taking some time in your big empty house.
I know. Yeah, I'm like, well, I'd just be hanging out drinking coffee anyway, so kind of good to have somebody to hang out with.
I'll tell you what. It was so fun to catch up. And if I'm ever in Seattle, we got to go drink some beer. Next time you're back in town, let's do it here.
All right. Sounds great.
All right. Thanks, man.
All right. Take it easy.
And that'll do it here on the John of All Trades podcast, episode 71. Aaron Mercer, big thanks for being on the show, for taking some time in your new digs up in Seattle, man. Much, much success to you. Can't wait to get together and share a beer with you. Follow him on Twitter, amercer83. Hit him up on LinkedIn, find out more about what he does. He's getting more and more active in that space every day. And as long as you're on the social media platforms, check us out. John of All Trades on Facebook is JOAT Pod. On Twitter, we are JOAT Pod. Our sponsor is 4Degrees, the number 4, DEGRE.ES. Online campaigns, online advertising, community building. It's all that you need to run your business, to run a campaign, to get your message in front of the people who need to see it. 4Degrees will do it, and do it at a very cost-effective rate. So, check them out on the web, the number 4, DEGRE.ES. One more plug, John of All Trades is a production of Deft Communications, Denver-based communication, engagement, and content. Hit us up on the web, deftcom.us, deftcom.us. Out of here for 2 weeks. You're on your own next week, so good luck to you. Have a happy Labor Day. Be very, very safe. I'll miss you, but we'll be back here in a week and a half. Hit us up on Facebook and Twitter. See the episode teased out. Drops on Wednesday. Available on iTunes and Stitcher. So, have a great long weekend. See you in 2 weeks. And until then, say goodnight, Gracie.